All right, good morning. Quarter past. Let's begin. Week four, which is to some extent the last week where we will be introducing something fundamentally new. So for those who think that there are a lot of things to see to, sure there is. I'll in a moment give a little overview so it doesn't seem endless. But first, last week's exercises on Friday. There were three. There was a short one on doing a weighted average, and that I hope that you by now feel confident doing, also with the chi-square. Secondly, there was a fit of company sizes, and I'm not going to present you with a solution, but just hope that you got the experience that this is hard, but it's not because the computers won't do what you want to do. It's hopefully because you tried many functions, and the data just doesn't fit those functions really. So here was a case of high statistics data. And now you see getting a good chi-square is really hard because there are so many subtle small effects, right? It could be for taxation reasons that companies below 20 are more likely to be there or not. All of these small effects can play in. And then finally, there was the coffee example. You should get a fit that goes, straight up and then flat and then straight up and leave the distance between the two as a parameter. If you do, I got 15.8 days of Christmas vacation plus minus 1.7 days. And I looked it up in the calendar and the true answer is 16 days. So yes, you can, from a few readings of a coffee machine, tell the length of the vacation. All right, with that, let's go to today's subject, which is hypothesis testing. But I'll start slightly different, namely on coincidences. Take a look at the sky and consider the size of the sun and the moon. The size seen from our point of view is that they should be completely uncorrelated. There's no reason why they should be the same, but they happen to be very close to. Is that a coincidence or not? Well, I'll leave that example be, but just quote Edgar Allan Poe in The Murders of Rue Morgue. Coincidences in general are great stumbling blocks in the way of that class of thinkers who have been educated to know nothing of the theory of probability and statistics I've put in, that theory to which the most glorious objects of human research are indebted for the most glorious of illustrations. So statistics is much about assigning probabilities to events and not be cheated by coincidences. Calculate their probability and judge their significance. Now, here is a signal received in 1974 when people were looking for extraterrestrial life. And they didn't have fancy plots and so on. So what they did for a 2D plot was just to put numbers and then use letters from there on. And a matrix printout shows a clear signal. It's called wow signal from the researcher who first saw it and said, whoa, they're sending from out there. As we all know, it was a signal. And that brings us to the assign a probability here, but also a philosophy in hypothesis testing that I'll get to in a moment. And then instead of, how about this? Imagine you received this. Well, look at it, and now it's been colored. In a moment, you'll see why. Well, wisely, you decide to plot it. And here you see that there is pattern to it. But how would you quantify if there was pattern to it or it was just random? And we'll get to that more in a moment. Now, it turns out that 1679 is not a prime number, but it's a multiplication of two prime numbers. So you can either do it 23 by 73 or 73 by 23. And if you do so, you get the archival message, which is not one we received, it's one we've sent. And this shows both the digits and where we are in the solar system and how many humans we are and how to send a signal and our solar system. You can read more about it on Wikipedia. But we're back to the, is this random or not? Assign a probability. Now, that brings us to the main subject, namely hypothesis testing. So for hypothesis testing, well, where are we now? And here's the overview that I admit to have failed to show you for a little while. But hypothesis testing is down here. And as you see, it's one of the sort of four main directions. And what does the hypothesis testing consist of? Well, first you have to think about if the assumptions are fulfilled. And then secondly, you can look at the difference between numbers in units of their uncertainty, right? That's what we do for almost everything. And there's a Z test. Well, that's if statistics is high or if you know the uncertainty or the root mean square. And a T test is when you don't. That was this student's T distribution. And then there are a variety of tests. We've also been in the chi-square, and there's one called Kolmogorov or Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, which is an important one. And then there's the Anderson-Darling test. There's a whole list of them, and I'll return to those in a moment. And then if you look at it, that actually means that we covered most things. We have standard mean and standard deviation and estimators. We've been plotting things. I'll return a little to more histograms. We've talked about uncertainties and calculated them and done error propagation. Sure, there's confidence intervals and limits to be considered. We've talked about the chi-square and the likelihood. We've done fitting. We talked about PDFs and why things tend to be Gaussian when it's the result of input from many things. We did simulation, how to generate random numbers according to the transformation or the accept-reject method. And well, you can imagine how to use those for cross-checks and for experimental design. And now we're in the last part here. There's also something called, multidimensional analysis, which relates to the Fisher discriminant, which is a linear version of machine learning, which means we're pretty much around. And so, rest assured that the rest of the course actually is dedicated more or less to play around in this space and gain experience with it and repeat it and apply it. So that's the plan. But let's jump to today's subject, hypothesis testing. And this is, slightly long. I'm going to say a lot about it. So we're probably going to go a little past 9 in today's lecture, but I hope you'll survive that. So suppose in a beer testing that someone gets 9 out of 10 right. Does that prove that the person can taste difference between beers? Well, sounds good, right? But the answer is no, it can't prove that. You cannot prove a hypothesis. You can only knock down hypotheses. You can only say that the result is inconsistent at some significance level, given by the p-value of doing this, with the hypothesis that the person chose at random. So the result shows most likely that the person didn't choose at random. But it could be that they were either cheating consciously or unconsciously, or they could test the difference or so on. But in statistics, you can never prove a hypothesis directly. You set up an alternative hypothesis, and then you can disprove these. That's how things work in statistics. It's almost like Alice in Wonderland. And I think that's also how Barlow introduces it. So imagine hypothesis testing is a little like a court of law. So there's a basic hypothesis, which is called the null hypothesis. And in a court of law, that would be that the person is innocent. And then there's the alternative hypothesis, which is guilty. And this we denote H0 and H1, or also HA, or there are a multitude of ways to do it, but this is typical. But the null and the alternative are sort of the classic names of this. And then you judge, and you can do sort of, you can make two mistakes. Let's suppose that the person is truly innocent and you acquit the person. Well, so you accept the null hypothesis. Well, that's the right decision. So that's great. Let's assume that the person is truly guilty and you convict the person. So now you reject the null hypothesis. Well, that's also the right decision. Then you might have a case where the person is truly guilty, but you acquit the person. That's of course a wrong decision. And this is an error of what's called type two. Whereas if the person is truly innocent, but you convict the person, that's also a wrong decision, and that's an error of type one. And depending on where you set the cut, these two rates of errors, well, you can't improve on one without changing the other. You can't change one without the other. That depends on how strict you are. In a court of law, you would much rather acquit a guilty than convict an innocent. And for that reason, you really need good proof. Now, notice that while you can reject hypothesis, the alternative is just that you can accept. But it might be that you can accept both H0 and H1. What do you do then? Well, in a court of law, then you, of course, leave the person innocent. And that is why sometimes it happens that somebody who's truly guilty, well, there wasn't evidence enough, and so you acquit the person because you could not reject the hypothesis that the person was innocent, right? That's why it has to be beyond reasonable doubt. And reasonable doubt is hard to put a p-value on, but I think, we're at the per mil level. Let's put a few things straight. So there's the null hypothesis and the alternative hypothesis. And then there is, actually the rate of these two happening, which is called alpha, which is the significance. And that is the rate of false positives. And then there's beta, which is defined as 1 minus the power, which is the rate of false negatives. So here you have false positive because it was a positive, the person was guilty, but you didn't find it. And here's a false negative. You thought you found somebody who was guilty, but in fact, they were not. And what you define as the null and the alternative hypothesis, well, in a court of law, it's simple. And in medicine, it's simple, right? The null hypothesis is that you're healthy. But sometimes it's not that easy to know what these, typically the null is the simplest hypothesis. Data is only background. There's no peak here. Whereas the alternative would be data is background plus a signal. So, and there are many, many namings. I'll get to that in a moment, but let's for now just keep it as simple as possible. So here is again, the same table, but where, here's the rate of type one errors is alpha and the rate of type two errors is beta. And we're striving to make statistical tests which keeps the most in the diagonal. We'll get back to how you measure exactly this. So here's again a decision and what you do to take decisions is that you calculate a test statistics. This could be a p-value, this could be all sorts of things. But one where the distribution for the null hypothesis is 1 and the distribution for the alternative hypothesis is 1. For example, let's say that you were doing IQ tests and you wanted to test if people were clever. Well, you have to define clever. And let's say that those who are just ordinarily clever, or the average, they have an IQ of 100, while those you consider clever have an IQ of 110. But you can't measure that accurately. So you get distributions which overlap. In case they don't overlap, let's say they're really sharp. Well, then it's very easy, you know, if it's above 105, then you're clever, otherwise not. And you would never be making a mistake. But in reality, of course, these typically overlap. Otherwise, it's not a problem, right? In a case where, you know, is this red or blue? And unless your eyes do not distinguish color very well, then you can clearly see that the wavelength difference between the two is extreme. You would never make a mistake here. But in IQ testing, I would dare say that that comes with some uncertainty. And you might then say, well, I want a very exclusive club. I'm okay with throwing away some who are actually clever. I just don't want too many normal persons in here. So then you don't, well, then you just raise the cut. Note how both alpha and beta are going to change as you raise the cut. And alpha is then the rate of those falling in. So that's the integral from here, 107.5 and upwards. Whereas beta is the integral of the other curve downwards. So the purpose of a test is to yield, you know, a distribution for the null and a distribution for the alternative, which are as separate from each other as possible, and then be able to make a choice. And as separated from each other as possible, well, the sharper these two peaks are, the smaller the rate of mistakes is, alpha and beta are. But for a given test, you when you change alpha, you also change beta. All right. And that is typically where I would say machine learning enters, just to say that, you know, if you can, with machine learning, provide a test statistic which measures people's IQ better, then these peaks get sharper and the error rate becomes smaller. That's typically where it enters. Now, here are four different tests. And I'm going to ask you, which of these are the best? Where are signal and background most separated? Well, they're not very alike, these distributions. And don't worry, I chose them not to be alike. And so it can be hard to sort of see, all right, which one is the most separated here? Well, it might look like this, might look like this. What is this? What happens is that, how do you evaluate that? Well, imagine you were to select a cut, let's say zero. Then you would say, I can calculate alpha and beta, right? The integral of one curve up and the integral of the other curve down. I could do the same here, here, and here, and then I could compare just at that value. You know, who had the smallest alpha, who had the smallest beta. But who says I want to put the cut here? What if I chose another cut here or up here? Well, then I'd get different values for all of them. Yeah, sure. But if you were to plot all these values, then an infinitesimal change would put a point right next to, a little over, a little up. And you could draw a whole curve doing that. So by making an integral for a lot of different points, you get a curve. And this is called the rock curve. Here is an example drawing of a rock curve. Now imagine that the two distributions lie exactly on top of each other. Then when you've selected half for this, it would also be half for that. And that corresponds to the curve along here, where that's just a random decision. And what are on the axes here? Well, this is your ability to choose signal, and this is your ability to choose background. Now, the ideal test, where the two are completely separate, is that you end up in the way in the corner. Why is that? Well, let's just go back to the original. If this was super sharp and the other one was super sharp, then when you made a cut here, you'd have an integral of 100% of one and 0% of the other, which is exactly what goes in the corner. Here, those who made the curve chose to sort of flip this around. And this is a, say, word of warning in general. Each field of science has reinvented its own rock curve. So whether the no prediction line lies this way or that way, or one of the scales are logarithmic, and whether you switch the two and which end you count from can change between fields. And then you might say, do I need to memorize, what is that, perhaps 16 different ways of doing a rock curve? The answer is fortunately not. A rock curve always starts in the corners, in the diagonal corners, and it always tries to go one way only. So by looking at it, you immediately see, okay, which way are we going here? Of course, it's good to read on the axes. Nothing against that, but it doesn't look that different. Here's another one, which happened to, well, I've chosen true positive rate and false positive rate. And see here, there are also three selections. There's a strict threshold. Well, it only chooses, 45% of the signal, but it lets very little background in, right? At the other end of the scale is a lax threshold. It chooses 97% of the signal, but it also lets half the background in. Where to make a choice here depends on the problem, right? In law, you don't want to put innocent people to prison. So you're sort of, you have a very strict threshold for saying that someone is guilty. In medicine, I think it's the opposite. You don't want to send someone out saying, yeah, you're fine, if they're really ill. So that's the other end of the scale. Where to put the optimum? Well, that's not easy. I would say when people are looking for signal in background, there is, well, the significance of a signal, and this is just counting. Well, you have some number of potential signal events, you call them S, and then you have some background underneath, you call it B. And well, if it's a small signal on a big background, then the uncertainty on S is square root of B. So here's the number of sigmas away from just zero. So sometimes people optimize that, just to mention it. It all depends on the case. Now, I mentioned that there are many names in use here. And I just wanted to say Wikipedia has an excellent page on this. So what I showed you before was this corner up here. Right? What is the true condition and what's the predicted condition? True positive, true negatives, and so on. And then it calculates all sorts of things. True positive rate, false negative rate, so on. You see here, there's quite a few. And I would say, don't worry too much about those. Conceptually, know that, all right, you sometimes make one type of mistake, sometimes another. There's a rate of making a mistake. And the only reason why I put this score in is because it's sometimes used for optimization. Where to choose it? Well, here was one method, here's another. Finally, there's people who say, well, I'm just going to do the integral of the rock curve. So that's the area under the curve, the AUC. So in this, what you would be doing is you'd just integrate from here to here. And if the integral is a half, you're doing terribly, it's just random. And if the integral is one, you're doing perfect. And this is often used actually in machine learning for optimizing the performance. So the AUC is a loss function. There are better ways, but it's often used also to show the performance. All right, that was a big chunk. Let's just try to take an example. Well, here's an example of the dashed curve versus all the others. And from each of these cases, well, you would say the dashed curve and the blue curve, well, they overlap a lot. What is the rock curve going to look like? Well, it's going to look like that. It's not exactly on the diagonal here, but it's not very separated either. Well, the green and the dashed are more separated. Well, that gives that curve the red here. And well, the dashed and the cyan curve, they're pretty separated. All right, so there you get a rock curve, which is, you know, towards the corner. An example from my own research is that, well, you want to separate signal and background, never mind what it is. But you see, there's a signal distribution in red and a background distribution in blue. And when you plot that, you get a rock curve. Oh, why is it now the other way? Well, that's just depending on the definition of the axis, but there's still sort of an imaginary dashed line here. And what I tried was to optimize things, to separate things better. So it's about pushing this curve into the corner. And I tried different things. I started from the red curve, and then I tried different things. And for each idea I had, well, it sort of pushed things more and more into this corner. Notice how I changed the axis here now to be logarithmic. And how could I quantify it? Well, I just chose to say not area under the curve, but typically you want to choose most of the signal. So I just put a line here and said, well, how much background can I get rid of? Here's another example. You have two methods, the in full and the dashed. And it turns out that the dashed is a likelihood method and the in full is a machine learning method. And the corresponding rock curves can be seen here. And the likelihood method was here in is here in red, whereas the others are here in, well, and there were three different ways of doing it. But the rock curve goes underneath, so that's good. And in this case, we made a ratio of rock curves just to show, well, what's the improvement? And it turns out that, you know, if you really have a lax cut, then there's actually no real improvement. But then it rises, and quickly it rises to about a factor two. So that is what we sort of found. We could, reject a lot more background. We could also say, we'll take the same amount of background here, the background level, but get more signal through. But if you're already 92% efficient, then there's a limit to how much you can gain. All right, that was hypothesis testing. How do you best separate signal and background? Well, I would then say again, remember I said that the likelihood ratio can actually be shown. If you have a simple hypothesis, then the likelihood ratio can be shown to be the optimal one. Remember, you cannot continue to do get infinitely good at this. There's a limited amount of information in the data. And so the rock curve will only go so far. And Peter asked, what did I actually do to increase my rock curve by 38%? Notice I didn't increase my rock curve by 38%. I increased my ability to reject background by 38%. Well, first I took the step which I thought was going to help the most, which was to say, I'm calculating something called isolation here, and I included more particles in that calculation. And that improved things, but not a lot, admittedly. Then I said, instead of just going low in momentum, maybe I should just accept more particles, even if they are certain to be related to this event or not, or be well reconstructed. And that actually gained me a lot. And then I had myself done a lot of work on how to weigh things in two directions. And that gave some more, but actually it was the second step which gave me a lot. And I didn't change a model. I just calculated this distribution where I produced a new isolation variable and did the rock curve based on this using various ideas. So that is what I did. That is what I worked on. I hope that answers your question, Peter. And how do you optimize this? Well, if you can write a simple likelihood, then that is optimal. The problem is, what if it's not a PDF, you know? What if it's in high dimensional space and it's very correlated and have correlations you don't know? Well, in that case, it's a challenge. And this is where a whole array of tests comes into play. And it's those tests I want to go through now. So first of all, what's the testing procedure? And I've written it here. So first you have to have an initial and an alternative hypothesis. And then you have to consider the assumptions. You know, do things have to be independent? Do I rely on some distribution, so on? And then you have to choose, what am I going to use as my test statistic? And the test statistic might simply be the mean, right? I have three measurements from yesterday and I have three from today. And the question is if anything changed. Well, how about comparing the mean of these to the mean of these? So that could be as simple as that. And then I derive a test statistic where I know the distribution of them. So under the null hypothesis, these two would have the same mean. And so if I calculated the distance between them and they were just randomly taken, then I should get a flat distribution in p-values. But if they were not the same, then I should get some steep curve towards low end of p-values, because suddenly they would not agree. The chance of them agreeing would be, well, skewed towards the low value. And calculating that distribution might be hard, or maybe I don't do it. That's the one smart thing about p-values, that here I know the distribution of the null hypothesis. It's flat. And now when I get a low p-value, well, it's up to me to decide, or whoever reads what I'm trying to convince people of, whether it's enough or not. So next you select a significance level, which means, when am I going to accept it? Is it when, you know, the null hypothesis has a 1 per mil chance of being right? So this depends on the field. And there's a variety from medicine and biology at 5% and downwards, I would say. And now you compute the test statistic in the data and see what value it actually had, right? What IQ value did people actually get in the test? And then you calculate the probability and then you reject the null hypothesis if it's for the alternative, if the p-value is below some significance level for the null and not for the alternative. This is summarized here. You have to start by stating your hypothesis and your criteria for selection, and then you compute your test statistic. And based on that, you make a decision, but that should be an automatic one once you've stated one and two. Now, what often happens, I would say, is that you start by doing three. You say, ah, man, here's my data. Let me calculate the difference in the means without thinking even about the first two. And I would say, even if it's small scale, it's healthy to think about the two. Think about, what am I going to do? I'm going to calculate the difference of the means in units of the uncertainties, and then I'm going to select if they're more than 3 sigma apart. Right? It would be as simple as that. But often people do three and then go back and consider this. And that's a bit biased. So try to do one and two. And here I can mention blinding, for example, because if you, for your calculation of your test statistic in the data are blinded, well, then you can't make a decision until all things are set. So that's a healthy thing to do. So back to the philosophy of hypothesis testing. Now, you can never prove a hypothesis. You can accept a hypothesis, but that doesn't exclude all other hypotheses. Sometimes that's quite reasonable. Let's say you have three functions that all go through the data nicely. Well, then you accept the three. Remember when introducing the chi-square with this sort of oscillation, right? If the errors were large, all the four hypotheses were good. But you can reject a hypothesis based on its probability of having the correct p-value. And so in hypothesis testing, the line of reasoning is that if you want to prove your pet hypotheses, well, then you set up the alternative hypotheses and you shoot them down. And once they're all shot, well, last hypothesis standing is hopefully yours. But careful to aim at that. Here's the example I've shown earlier from determining what type of particle the discovered Higgs particle was. Was it a spin zero in blue as expected, or a spin two? And here, well, ahead of time, we calculated what the red curve would look like, what you should expect if it was spin two, and the blue curve, what you should expect if it was spin zero. And then we calculated a test statistic, which was an advanced likelihood ratio between the decay angles. And I can say I made a contribution to the Higgs discovery in doing this with machine learning, trying to separate these two as much as possible. And when everything was set, we calculated the black value, namely given the data we have, what is this value? And we had tried hard to make Q, you know, separating the two hypotheses as much as possible. And then, well, it chose this value. And that was lucky because, well, the integral from here and upwards of the red is very small, right? So it was less outside the three sigma range, whereas it coincided well with the blue. So published a paper saying, well, it's been zero, most likely. And here the options were quite discrete and few. So now I'm going to repeat the Niemann-Pearson lemma, which is that the likelihood ratio between the null and the alternative hypothesis is, I would say, loosely stated, the most powerful test there is. But that is if the two hypotheses are what's called simple. So that could be our original IQ test saying, look, either people have an IQ of 100 or they have an IQ of 110. And those are the two hypotheses and there are no playing around. But we know that there is a measurement uncertainty. So the 100, we're going to measure with 100 plus minus 5, and 110 is going to be 110 plus minus 5. Well, in that case, the likelihood ratio is the most powerful. The problem is, it's not always easy to write up the likelihood ratio in a complex situation. So let's say that you're, for example, doing a fit of a peak. So the null hypothesis would be fitting with the background only PDF, which would hopefully have a hard time if there's a big peak in the middle of the whole thing. You would get a very bad likelihood. And alternatively is that it's the background along with a peak. And remember how the likelihood had this offset, which we could never know, but the likelihood ratio does not. Here the offset cancels out. And if you take minus two log, well, then it's actually the difference between the two and this additive constant cancels out. So that's why it works. And then you would say, well, if the likelihood value coming out of your fit, this F-val, which is the chi-square, if it's a chi-square fit, it's the likelihood value if it's a likelihood fit. And that's why if it's a likelihood fit, careful of just saying, oh, that's probably the chi-square value. I'll use it as such. Well, that can be interpreted. But then now the alternative model had both a background and a peak in it, whereas the background model, well, the null only had the background in it. So this had more parameters, but it contains this one. And it has three parameters more if it's a simple peak, namely normalization, mean, and width. Three parameters of a Gaussian. And then D distributes itself like a chi-square distribution with 3 degrees of freedom, and you can again calculate a p-value of the null hypothesis. All right, I still haven't mentioned any specific tests. So here was what I just said about the Wilks theorem. And don't worry, this is where things get complicated, I want you to know this and be able to set it up, but we'll have exercises setting it up, and it's not part of the core curriculum. So that might only be an end station of a question on the exam, just to let you know. Common statistical tests. This is the list you want to look at. Now, there's a one sample test. For example, you measured a value and you want to compare it to some constant. Here's an example, and what do? Well, you take your measured value minus the constant that you're comparing to in, well, the difference between the two in units of the uncertainty on your value here, and then you compare it and ask, how many sigma am I away? This is mentally the simplest test there is. It might be that whatever you measured is based on very few values and you don't know the uncertainty. You just infer it from, well, you have two measurements and you get the uncertainty from the standard deviation of those two values. Well, then you can see you don't know that value very well, the uncertainty. And then it's not a Z test. Now it's a T test, which means instead of using the Gaussian, you know, how many sigmas are you away, you use the student's T distribution. This is exactly the difference between a Z test and a T test. All right. You might also compare two sample tests. So I have measured this value in my experiment, but I also have a smart control channel here where I measured the same thing, but should get a different value if there's an effect. You know, these were given the drug, these were given a placebo type. And then, well, it's back to the good old Z test, namely you just measure the difference in units of the uncertainty. You just have two samples now. For the two sample test, I think Barlow has quite a good and thorough sort of walk through this under different conditions. Then there's the paired test. This is, for example, when you use twins for a genetic bias, to control a genetic bias. Right, so then you pair things up. And in that case, you have to consider that. Then there's the chi-squared test, which we know and love already. Well, love is perhaps a strong word, but at least you should know about it. And then there are a few more, namely the Komarov-Smirnov test or the Komarov test. And this tests the compatibility between two samples, and it yields a p-value. I'll give an example in a moment. And then there are three more tests, one called a Runs test, one which is an exact test, and one which is an F test. The Runs test is, you know, does your data lie above or below for, you know, long periods, long runs. Fisher's exact test is for something called contingency tables, 2x2 tables. And the F test is to see differences between variances and if grouping is interesting. So which test to use? Well, that is up to the problem itself. And only experience and trying gives you some sort of feeling for what should I be doing here. So I can't say much about that. There was the difference between the Z test and the T test. Well, that depends on if it's few measurements or many. Here's the student's T distribution. And you see, if you base your uncertainty on only a few measurements, and there might be a reason why you only have a few, right? Then the tails are longer, and you should allow for that before you say, ah, they're different. But, you know, once you have 10, it resembles the Gaussian distribution in black very much. Also, you should consider, here's the sort of rule of thumb. If you have many measurements, or if you know the uncertainty, Well, then it's a Z test. Otherwise, it's a T test. And then Jakob asks, are you going to talk about multiple testing corrections? Yes, I am. Just not today, simply to limit the amount of information. We're at 45 minutes now and I'm not finished. So that's a rule of thumb. And then also you have to consider whether it's a one-sided or a two-sided test. For example, if you're looking medically for a difference between a control sample and those who gave the drug, you want to know if this sample improved. You know, what if they're more ill? Well, you probably want to know that as well, but you have to think about, you know, if you consider both cases interesting or just one side. Whether you should do the integral of the Gaussian or the t-distribution, you know, one way or both ways. Usually logic applies here. The chi-square test we know, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. And here's just the reduced chi-square, y that has to be closer and closer to one as the degrees of freedom goes up. I want to go to the Komarov-Smirnov test. What is that? Well, imagine that you're given two distributions, two set of measurements, and you want to know if they're different. Well, again, as I said, and let's just take a specific example. Here you measure two populations. In this case, it's exoplanets. And you want to know if the blue distribution is different from the red distribution. You don't even know if this is Gaussian. It could have any distribution. You just want to know if these could come from the same underlying distribution or not. Well, what the Komarov-Smirnov test does is it says, I'm going to integrate one and the other, and I'm going to look at the largest difference. And given that I know how many entries there were in the two samples, and given that largest difference in the integral, I can actually calculate a p-value. Notice the small miracle here. Komarov and Smirnov were smart enough to figure out how big this difference, what the distribution should be for the null hypothesis. So we're back to the chi-square test again case. We know how to translate a chi-square value, sum, into a p-value because we know the distribution. Well, Komarov-Smirnov figured out that knowing the number of entries in these two samples, then they can turn the distance d into a p-value. And that is what the Komarov-Smirnov test does. So in this case, they said, they got 3.5 sigma. And the only requirement or assumption here is that the underlying distribution is continuous. It has to be a continuous underlying distribution here. Now, then you might say, but they bind it. Yeah, sure, but they don't need to bind it, right? The integral you can just do as a function of not binding it. So this is the Komarov-Smirnov test. There is also a Kuiper test, which detects, well, both the positive and the negative shift. So not just the biggest. And so this should be slightly more powerful, but frankly, I've never come across it. So now I just wanted you to know. So if you see integrals that look like this, well, you might want to consider. And these tests are the ones you should know by heart, right? We consider things as a difference either between a constant and our sample or two sample between the two in units of the uncertainty. It might be a paired test, or we can do a chi-square, or we can do a Komarov. This you need to know by heart. What are the rest then? Well, they're a nice test to have in the back of your hand. The Runs test, and here's the reference in Barlow, is a test which tests, you know, if points are above or below some value, heads or tails. It might be that you flip a coin 100 times and 50 come out head and 50 come out tails. And then you would say, it's a fair coin. But then you discover that the first 50 were heads and the last 50 were tail. And this should rouse something in you because it's not likely to see that pattern. right? There are only two runs in it. Now, imagine you are doing a fit to this data and you do it with a line. And the errors are large enough that notice the chi-square of this would be fine, but you would say, but this looks strange, right? First you have three above, then you have everyone below until it shifts above again. Now, that's weird. I can't have that. Well, what do you do then? Well, you calculate the number of runs. So in this example, here's a run, here's a run, here's a run, here's a run, and here's a run, and here's a run. So there are six runs in this. And then you say, well, what should I compare it to? And up here, there are three runs. Well, here the mean and the variance can be calculated ahead of time. So again, you can know how many runs you would expect, and now you can compare. Sorry. So above here, n is 12, n positive and n negative are 6 each. So you should see 7 runs, and the variation in that, the standard deviation, should be 1.75. Well, in fact, you only see 3. All right. So 7 minus 3, so we're 4 away. And this is the uncertainty, and I don't know why I didn't write 76 here, but I gave 2.4 sigma away. So actually, this is not very likely to be, you know, just by coincidence, above and below and above. So here, the mean and uncertainty is in the number of runs. Yeah, this is the mean number of runs you should see, and this is the variance on that mean. Thanks, Peter. So that's the runs test. And for example, for flipping a coin, you of course want to look at the fraction of heads and tails, but this might be okay. And there's still something dodgy behind it. Then there's Fisher's exact test. Well, what is the assumption in runs test? I would say hardly any, that you can define a run, I think. Fisher's exact test. Well, this is where we consider a contingency table. And what's a contingency table? Well, it's a 2x2 table. So you have A, B, C, and D, 4 different numbers. And then you can do the sum around here. And now you can ask, is belonging to row 1 or 2 correlated with belonging to column 1 or 2? Is there any correlation between this? Or is it just random? And Fisher's exact test calculates the probability, the p-value of this being random. It's calculated as follows. And as you can see, it has the faculty in it, which means that's hard to calculate if the numbers are high. But if they're small, remember, we hate small statistics. In high statistics case, you could do this with a chi-square because you can say, well, given that half is in row 1 and half is in row 2, and for example, half is in column 1 and half in column 2, and you know this from the data, I know exactly what to expect for these 4 places. Let me compare it to the real data. Then you set up a chi-square. But if the statistics is small, and here's an example taken from Wikipedia. It's a case of men and women, and if the number of people dieting or non-dieting. And I simply took it from there. I don't care what is in the rows or in the columns. But we have the summary here and we can calculate. Is this by random or is there correlation between your gender and dieting or not? Well, you calculate and you get 1.3 per mil. So if this was your data, you would say there's probably a correlation between the two. It doesn't say how or why or anything. It just says you're testing the null hypothesis that there is no correlation. And the answer is a p-value, and then you judge based on that. Finally, there's the F-test. I'm not going to go through that. I listed it here. And finally, there's the Anderson-Darling test, which is just, it's a very powerful test between data, which cumulative data would be written capital F of N, so you sort it, and a distribution F, integrated. And what you do is actually you look at the difference in units of some weight, and then you integrate over the whole thing. Now, this in general is called the von Mises test, Kramer von Mises test. And Anderson Darling realized that if you put this in the denominator, well, then you put some emphasis, mostly more on the tails, and it works really nicely. There are alternative tests. One is the Shapiro-Wilkes test, and I put on the course webpage links to each of them. The Shapiro-Wilkes, in a comparison, was slightly more powerful than the Anderson-Darling. The Anderson-Darling is relatively simple. And all of these are implemented in the Python statistics package for various assumptions here. In the end, when to reject a hypothesis, and that depends on many things. Lewis Lyons has tried to write a paper up on that. I've linked it. And well, this is from particle physics, but he says, how big is the degree of surprise? What is the impact? What is the look elsewhere effect? Meaning, you know, how many tests did you actually do? Because if you do a lot of tests, well, then seeing something significant, it's not that significant. Remember, we talked about that regarding how much you should reduce your significance from the local significance to the global significance. So that also answers the multiple testing question Jakob had. Are there systematics involved in this? And then he gives his own blunt line of thinking of, you know, how many sigmas should you require? Sometimes less than five, because, well, you know, if there's no degree of surprise and, you know, it's not going to be pestered by different effects, well, three might be enough. You know, whereas if you discovered something that was faster than the speed of light, well, the degree of surprise is enormous. The impact is enormous. You know, you should at least take eight sigma. And I remember somebody saying, I will believe everything, even, you know, the wildest things, if the evidence is solid enough. And the inverse of that is saying extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And with that, I'm going to stop here. And I even had one more set of slides to show, but I think I'll let you see it yourself. Yes, Jakob, I passed on the F test quickly and over. And I'll gladly return to that with you and others if required, but I think we should take it offline because now I'm getting close to the 1 hour limit, and that I put as a hard limit. So let me just in the end say that I've compiled sort of a distribution, well, different p-value distributions. It should be flat, but maybe it has a peak towards zero. There could be a reason for that. There's a peak towards one, both ways, sparse, weird. Well, and here's a test from real life where I managed to get distribution, which was not exactly flat, but close to. So my errors were slightly too small. That's what gives the peak towards this end. And then there was a slight peak here. Well, those were the cases that were actually not true, but because of experimental reasons, I couldn't simply clean up in it. I'll let you go through that by yourself and make sure that we end here.